From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
President Bush gets a lively reception in Europe. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Demonstrations turned into angry protests tonight in Vienna, where President Bush was called the number one terrorist in the world. At a heated press conference, the president dismissed as absurd polls showing that Europeans think the U.S. is more dangerous than Iran. The president also said he wants to close the Guantanamo Bay prison, and the chancellor of Austria signaled possible help in relocating prisoners. On To the Point, more on the latest attempt to mend fences with some of America's most important allies. What about Iran, Iraq, and Europe's own problems with radical Islam? On Reporter's Notebook later on, a breakthrough that also suggests limitations in stem cell research. First, the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Protesters threw smoke bombs as President Bush left Vienna tonight. On To the Point, will Austria and other countries help relocate prisoners if Guantanamo Bay is shut down? What did the European Union have to say about Iraq, Iran, and Europe's own problems with radical Islam? On Reporter's Notebook, stem cell research has enabled paralyzed mice to walk, but application to humans could be a long way off. First, this news update. As the Senate debated timetables for troop withdrawal today, the Pentagon announced that 21,000 soldiers will be sent to replace those who were coming home. Meantime, the Marine Corps plans to charge seven Marines and a sailor with murder. They're being held at Camp Pendleton Marine Base in Southern California, where Tony Parry is reporting for the Los Angeles Times. Tony, I know the formal announcement has not yet been made. It is, however, anticipated soon. What incident in Iraq is involved?
This is an incident in an Iraqi village called Hamandiya, occurred in late April, April 26th, in which the Marines and a Navy corpsman allegedly went into an Iraqi home, pulled out a 52-year-old man who was unarmed, and then, without provocation, shot and killed him, and then tried to cover up their crime by planting near the body an AK-47 and a shovel, which would suggest that he was an insurgent caught planting a roadside bomb. Now, they filed a report to that extent, but then the Iraqi family brought their version of events to military authorities, and that began an investigation that's brought us to this point here of charges being filed in the next few hours against these eight service personnel.
What is liable to happen after the charges have, in fact, been filed?
Well, it looks like charges, as you say, of murder, conspiracy, probably kidnapping for dragging someone out of a building. I don't know exactly the spreadsheet of it, how many murder, how many this, how many that, but it's very serious. Would be the first time Marines from Camp Pendleton have been charged with murder of an Iraqi during this offensive, this three-year offensive. The system then begins, what they call an Article 32, which is similar to a preliminary hearing or a grand jury in which evidence is presented. Now, let's get a giant caveat on the table here. This investigation was done by the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. I have seen their reports before, look very, very damning and very, very conclusive, but yet at Article 32s be pretty well picked apart by defense attorneys. And there are some good defense attorneys in this case, so let's hold our judgment until we see what the evidence is and what the defense says about that evidence.
Everybody innocent until proven guilty. We're talking with Tony Parry with
Absolutely.
The Los Angeles Times. Are they going to be represented by military attorneys or civilian attorneys?
Combination. They all get a military attorney by military rules. They can also hire at their own expense civilian attorneys, and several that I know have done that, and very good civilian attorneys, including Jeremiah Sullivan out of San Diego, who defended successfully two SEALs accused of abusing a prisoner near Abu Ghraib. So they've got some very good legal firepower on their side. So, again, we're a long way towards any sort of ultimate decision. Article 32 would decide whether it goes to court-martial, and then court-martial a full-out trial. Hovering all over this, don't forget, this is the military. It's different than the civilian system. The commanding general will decide whether this case goes forward after the Article 32.
All right. Again, we have seven Marines and one sailor to be charged with murder in the killing of one person. This, as you said, occurred in Hamdaniya. That's a different place from Haditha, where there are reports that 24 Iraqi civilians were killed by other Marines. What's happened to that case, as far as we know?
That case is more involved, as you know, and has more personnel involved and more victims, and a much more complex situation occurred November 19th. Two reports still being worked on, one by the Naval Criminal Investigative Service to see if there are any criminal charges that are appropriate, but also a report to see if there was any sort of cover-up by Marine higher-ups. In that latter report, it seems as if they've concluded that, no, there was no cover-up, but what there was a kind of lassitude among officers from the company level up to division level. There were red flags that they should have looked at this more carefully, and they did not. So that report is sitting in Baghdad with the top general of the coalition forces. The Naval Criminal Investigative Service that could result in criminal charges is still working along. I think we're talking August before we know about that one.
Are there indications that in the Hamdaniya case that we're talking about now, higher-ups were involved in any sort of cover-up?
No, in fact, just the opposite. There's indication that in the wake of the Haditha case, which the military was very slow to get onto until Time magazine embarrassed them by doing some good reporting that showed that the initial story by the Marines just didn't hold up. In this case, in the Hamdaniya case, they jumped on it immediately. In fact, there are some allegations they jumped on it too quickly by defense attorneys saying, hey, you're just trying to make up for the fact you were slow in this other case. You're rushing to judgment in this case. We'll see. No, no cover-up in this one. In fact, just the opposite. They may have moved too quickly. That'll all be vetted at the Article 32 or at a court-martial.
What, under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, would be the penalty for people found guilty of murder?
Well, premeditated murder, and that's a tall charge, as you can imagine. That can be the death penalty. Straight-out murder, second-degree murder, whatever, can be life imprisonment. Now, we've not seen that for the Camp Pendleton personnel. We had some charge in the death of a prisoner, but it wasn't murder charges. This is very serious stuff.
Tony Perry at Camp Pendleton for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you very much for being with us.
Anytime.
In a moment, President Bush gets a warm reception in Europe on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Ali back with To the Point. Several hundred demonstrators paraded today in Vienna, where President Bush was meeting with leaders of the European Union. Then tonight, as the president prepared to leave, there were smoke bombs thrown in the street. Frederica Leibel is covering the president's visit for the Austrian daily Die Presse. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hello.
What can you tell us about what happened in the streets as the president was leaving town?
Well, what happened all day, it had been a very peaceful demonstration, people demonstrating for global peace, and nothing really happened. The president took off at 10 to 7, and about half an hour later, protesters stormed to where the meeting was held before, and about 50 rioters threw smoke bombs, and police had to come in with fire engine, so it was a bit of an ugly end to a basically peaceful demonstration all day.
Do you have any idea who the 50 were and whether or not they represented everybody or if they were just sort of a one group different from all of the others?
Well, I believe it's the usual hardcore group of rioters that will go protest against whatever gives them a chance to provoke an escalation. It was not primarily targeted at the president or whatever. They would escalate like that if they demonstrate against animal laws and things like that.
Didn't they, though, carry signs saying that President Bush was the number one terrorist in the world?
There were a number of signs like that. There were also signs that said, please help the planet and resign. But most of them just said, you know, Bush, go home, or we want global peace. So there wasn't a majority of really hostile banners to be seen.
To what extent do those protesters represent the people of Austria, do you think? I know that the media in Austria have been very critical of the president.
Well, those writers are not at all representative of the Austrian opinion. There was a very, what I said before, it was a very peaceful opposition. People just wanted to stress we don't share all of the policy lines of the Bush administration, but the rioters in no way represent the Austrian public.
What does the public feel, do you think?
Well, the president is hugely unpopular in Austria. He's made responsible for what happened after the war in Iraq and ongoing problems on the global, in the world. And people, a majority of people here feel that more diplomacy would be needed in the world.
Again, we're talking with Frederica Leibel, who is European correspondent for the Austrian daily Die Presse. At his press conference a little bit earlier in the day, President Bush himself raised the issue that has been most talked about, as I understand it, in the Austrian press by saying that EU leaders had asked him about Guantanamo Bay.
They brought up the concern about Guantanamo. And I understand their concerns, but let me explain my position. First, I'd like to end Guantanamo. I'd like it to be over with. One of the things we will do is we'll send people back to their home countries.
Again, the president speaking to the Austrian press today, back to Frederica Leibel. Were you surprised that the president himself, I know you were at the news conference, raised this issue, which has been so commonly talked about, I guess is the best way to put it, in the Austrian press?
Well, it was a surprise, and it was seen as a brilliant move, a very diplomatic move. He addressed it first. They spoke for about 50 minutes. He talked about human rights four times, and he stressed that he had understanding for concerns in Europe. So that was an absolutely successful attempt to further heal the divisions between the United States and Europe.
He was with the Austrian Chancellor, Wolfgang Schüssel. What did he have to say with respect to Guantanamo Bay?
Chancellor Schüssel stressed again that Europe very much wants to see it closed, but that Europe was willing to help the states by overcoming the problem. And he also said there shouldn't be any more gray zones. He stressed that Europe will never tolerate the people are held in a way that is in Europe perceived as beyond the human rights.
Has Austria been one of the countries involved in the extraordinary rendition by the CIA, the movement of prisoners from one country to another in order for them to be questioned in places where practices are used that aren't used by the United States?
No, Austria was not involved in that.
So that wasn't an issue then for the Chancellor?
It was mentioned. He said Europe should not be naive in the war on terrorism because Europe is also affected, not just the United States, and there are things that need to be done. But he stressed again, whatever you do to combat terrorism, please respect human rights.
Did it appear that he would be willing? I know the president said what he has said often, which is that he'd like to get rid of Guantanamo Bay, as we heard. But in addition to that, there is no place to send some of the prisoners involved, people he referred to as cold-blooded killers. And there has been some indication that countries in Europe might be helpful in that regard, so they wouldn't have to be sent back to Saudi Arabia and other places where they might not be safe.
Well, there was no clear reference that there are countries that are willing to take people, but there's one country that is not part of the European Union, namely Albania, that has recently taken five Chinese because they couldn't be sent back to China for fear of torture. And behind the scenes, you can hear that if there are concrete steps to close down Guantanamo, Europe is willing to find countries that might take refugees to try them or release them. So it's a possibility that it's feasible.
So did the Chancellor send any signals of that kind?
He not in a very clear way. He said, we have to help. We have to help find countries to take them.
Again, Frederica Leibel is European correspondent for the Austrian daily Die Presse. Heinz Gertner is professor of political science and international relations at the Austrian Institute for International Affairs. Professor, thank you for joining us today.
Good evening.
I understand that you were at the press conference as well. I'm interested
right.
in your take first on the Guantanamo issue, and then we'll move on to other questions as well. What about Guantanamo Bay?
I do think that was a brilliant move by the president that he addressed the issue by himself. But basically, it was a subject already in the last weeks in the European Union, and the European Union agreed that they should ask the president and the Americans to close down Guantanamo. However, it was a very general remark by the president to end Guantanamo and to go over with. And there was no clear date when to do it, and further issues have to be discussed, especially what to do with the detainees. And there was no commitment by the Europeans to take some of the prisoners, but I don't exclude it.
What about the president's comment that he's waiting for the United States Supreme Court, once again something he said before, to decide whether or not some of the prisoners have to be tried in civilian courts or whether they can be tried by military tribunals? Is that a nuance that you think many Europeans really understand?
Yes, because many international lawyers, they already requested that they have to be tried and on civilian courts or released. And this is a move in the direction the Europeans really wanted to hear.
There have been polls in Europe, particularly by the Pew Center for Research in the Public and the Press, indicating that Europeans feel that the United States is more dangerous to world peace than Iran or North Korea. I understand, Professor Gertner, that the president was asked about that today. He said that it was absurd. Do you think it is absurd? Europeans really feel that way?
I feel sorry that the American president has to defend himself in such a way to be compared to Iran and North Korea. Of course, that's absurd. But the question was not really whether the United States can be compared to this tyrannies. The question basically was about the different values and why the president is so unpopular in Europe. And I also know the figures by this Pew Research Center. And basically, the difference is not between America and Europe. The difference is between some American hawks and the mainstream European opinion on several issues, like multilateralism, United Nations authorization, use of force, also on the system of social security, religion, death penalty, things like that. So there's a difference, but it's not really a divide between Europe and the Americans. So.
Heinz Gertner, once again, professor of political science and international relations at the Austrian Institute for International Affairs. Back to Friederike Leibl with Die Presse. Were the questions by the Austrian press fairly challenging to President Bush?
I think at first you had the impression he didn't like being asked why he was so unpopular, but it also gave him a chance that he used them very well to defend his policy. He said, I don't govern by polls. I do what is best for my country and the world. So it gave him an opportunity by defending himself to stress his message again. So I think in the end it wasn't that much of a challenge.
Professor Gertner, how do you feel about the questions from the Austrian press? You indicated you were sorry to see the president questioned in the manner that he was. Did they go too far?
No, I don't think so. So the figures speak for themselves. Of course, Bush is not very popular, and he's not popular in Austria. So below 10% of Austrians thinks that Bush is a good president. However, I have to say, if you look at the figures about America, they are much better. But the figures changed after the Iraq war. So Bush had very good figures after 9/11 and even after the war in Afghanistan started. But the real unpopular thing was the Iraq war, and since then the president's polls didn't really recover.
Heinz Gertner, professor of political science and international relations in Austria. Tony Blankley is editorial page editor of the Washington Times. That's a paper with a conservative point of view in the nation's capital. Tony Blankley, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
We know that the president has been trying to mend fences in Europe. He made several trips to Europe last year. Here he is again. How do you think he's doing?
Well, I think he's doing about as well as he can, given that it's all we're talking rhetoric. In policy areas, where there are disputes, such as in the Doha trade round that will be coming up on agricultural subsidies and other issues, nice words won't solve the problem. But I think he certainly stopping the growling on our side of the pond has been reciprocated by a lack of growling, at least at the elite governmental level on the other side, and that's all to the good.
What about the concerns about human rights, Guantanamo Bay very specifically, and the fact that the president himself brought it up today, which Professor Gertner said he thought was a brilliant move?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think European statesmen are becoming almost as insincere in their public expressions as Mideastern statesmen, Saudi and Egyptian, have been for years, where they express indignation at various matters that are popularly held to be an object of indignation, while their security services work closely with us and continue to. Rendition is a pretty regular practice, but done, I think, with a coordination, as I understand it, of most of the Western and Middle Eastern intelligence services. And at that level of professionalism, they understand there are, in fact, really bad people that have to be moved around, and they are being moved around. But at the public level, everyone's got to be outraged, so we've seen the outrage.
And again, the president, from his standpoint, he's got to deal with this. I had some tough questions from the reporters in Austria. Do you think he's doing it as well as he can?
Well, I mean, you know, could Jack Kennedy pull it off better? Probably. Just stylistically, obviously, there's a certain style that's going to be more appealing to Europeans than others, and sort of the classical Western and American cowboy style is never going to play well. Reagan didn't play particularly well in Europe in his time. So stylistically, given his style, I think he's doing it pretty well. But I don't think he pays much of a political price back home for having any rude questions posed to him abroad. That probably helps him. Obviously, at another level, to the extent that that European attitudes make it harder for Bush to carry out his substantive policies, that is a real problem, of course.
Okay, Tony Blankley, once again, editorial page editor of The Washington Times. Come back to him, to our guests in Austria as well. First, though, let's hear from T.R. Reid. He is the Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, but he's on this program because he was the Post's former London Bureau Chief, and he's also author of The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. T.R. Reid, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren. Good to be back.
What about it? Has this current event and the events of the past few months done more or less to end American supremacy as far as Europe is concerned?
Well, Europeans absolutely don't like our choice in presidents. They absolutely don't like our foreign policy. And to the extent that they look at the war in Iraq, they look at Guantanamo, they think, boy, we figured things out better. We'd rather be European and have our own union than be united with the United States. So I'd say certainly the war in Iraq has made the Atlantic wider and made Europeans less willing to support or help the United States in its foreign policy ventures.
What about the distinction Tony Blankley just made between substantive policy concerns and public rhetoric? Do you think that the president is holding his own in this area? Or, again, Tony Blankley says, as far as it goes here at home, he doesn't pay any price, even if he's beaten up in the press in Europe.
Well, it may be true that for a president to go to Europe and get trashed by European reporters is good for you at home, but I think Americans are concerned about the fact that respect and admiration for our country is at the lowest level in 50 or 60 years. You mentioned this Pew survey that's shown a drastic drop in respect for our country since 2000 when President Bush won the presidency. And I think Americans are concerned about that, and, you know, if you want to see the price, look at Iraq. There's a war going on in Iraq. When George Bush's father invaded Iraq, other countries paid 90% of the cost and took about 70% of the casualties.
Okay, we're going to continue this thought and others on To the Point from PRI after a very brief break.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point, talking today about President Bush's trip to Europe. He has left Vienna, is on his way to Hungary. There were smoke bombs thrown in the streets of Vienna after peaceful protests all day long, with maybe several hundred people, 50 of them or so, apparently breaking out, throwing smoke bombs at the end of the day. We're talking now about the president's reception in Europe. Our current guest, T.R. Reid, Washington Post author and author of the book The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy, just telling us that respect for the United States is at its lowest level in 50 or 60 years. We're just comparing the situation to that when President Bush's father was in office and we had the Coalition of the Willing helping out in Iraq. What has been the state of of European relations with regard to Iraq. Do you think that anything will come out of this, this meeting today between the president and the leaders of the European Union? Should point out that the leaders of the other countries, per se, were not present, only the leaders of the European Union. T.R. Reid, go ahead.
I think it's going to be very hard for any democratically elected European leader to help us in Iraq. I mean, if you favor the war in Iraq, let's see, leaders who favored the war and supported the United States have lost elections in Italy, in Spain, in Norway, in Poland. It's not politically possible to support the war in Iraq, I think, in any European country. Denmark, I think, they still support our war. So he's not going to get much help there out of, we've spent, what, something like $400 or $500 billion, and the total European contribution to aid in Iraq is $250 million. It's nothing. So, no, he's failed to get support from Europe, and I doubt that he's going to get any now.
Tony Blankley, back to you, editorial page editor of The Washington Post. You said, the Washington Times, beg your pardon. Very different. Said earlier
They wouldn't like that over there, I don't think.
That's a different place altogether. You said earlier that the European statesmen are insincere, to use your term, and maybe they're just responding to the people of their countries.
Of course they are. I mean, that's the point. By the way, I agree with Mr. Reid's broad characterizations, although I'd point out that Schroeder, who opposed the war, also lost an election, that Chirac, who opposed the war, is down, somewhere around 20% job approval. I think Democratic leaders generally, including Bush and Blair and the others, are having a difficult time convincing their electorates that they are effectively leading their nations in these very difficult times. One flip of the question about how poorly we are viewed by Europeans, I wonder how much media the coverage there is in Europe of how lower Europe's Americans hold Europeans in esteem than we used to. I think the Iraq event has been traumatic on both sides of the pond. And I say that as a fervent supporter of Atlantic unity. My book last year, I identified as one of the most important foreign policy objectives is for us to try to rebuild our relations in Europe. So I don't take any comfort in this division because I think Western civilization needs to stick together.
Tony Blankley, editorial page editor, Washington Times. Let me go back to Heinz Gertner, our professor of political science and international relations at the Austrian Institute for International Affairs. T.R. Reid just pointed out that whereas the United States has spent hundreds of billions of dollars in Iraq, the European total of support is around $250 million. Do you think that the president was successful today in getting the European Union to provide any further assistance?
Of course, this was one of his intentions, and it reads in the final document that very generally that we will continue to assist in building an independent, stable, secure, democratic, prosperous, and united Iraq at peace with its neighbors and the international community. So that's as far as the president could go. So he got the moral support, but I don't really think that the Europeans might commit themselves to something more concrete. Of course, the president has some troubles because many countries of the coalition of the willing are withdrawing troops or announced to withdraw troops, and he has also this debate domestically at home, so he needs some support. But the Europeans didn't really pledge something concrete in terms of financing.
Of course, what he's asking for, as I understand it, is not support in the war per se, but rather for the reconstruction of Iraq. I take it, Professor, that you don't think he even got that, even for that purpose.
NATO is doing training troops and police forces, so he might get some help in this way. But in terms of money, I don't think it will be too much of an amount.
Frederica Leibel, let me go back to you, European correspondent for the Austrian Daily Die Presse. What about the question of Iran, another issue that the president very much wanted to bring up today? He said in his press conference he was very unhappy that the president of Iran, Mr. Ahmadinejad, had said that he won't respond to American overtures until August. How important is that issue to Europeans, and how important is it that the United States has made an offer to Iran to get involved in the talks?
Well, this is hugely important because it signals a turn in the U.S. policy for months and months and months. U.S. And the EU could not agree on a common line. For the first time now, you can see some sort of unified front, and they tried whatever they could today at the press conference to demonstrate that that unification in their stance on Iran. And both Bush and Chancellor Schüssel said, it's about time they decide, and they just wanted to show strength. And as long as they're unified, they have realized they can probably achieve more. And behind the scenes, you hear that the moderate tone that is now being used finds better response than in the past few months. So it's a good sign.
T.R. Reid, let me go back to you. Washington Post, United States of Europe, the new superpower and the end of American supremacy. What about this issue of Iran? Does it have the capacity, do you think, to bring together the countries of the European Union and the United States?
Yeah, I think it's doing that. I think the Europeans appreciate President Bush's approach because, look at it, it's multilateral and it's unmilitary. It's diplomatic. That's two things Europeans absolutely love. And it's two aspects that they generally don't see in President Bush's foreign policy. So, yeah, I think they're very pleased with that. I think the problem is, European nations and America have accepted nuclear weapons in China, Russia, Pakistan, India, and Israel. So I think it's going to be very hard to stop Iran. How are they going to do it?
Tony Blankley, with the Washington Times, what about this change on the part of the Bush administration to the multilateral diplomatic approach with regard to Iran, a major contrast, of course, at least for the moment, between that and what happened in Iraq? Is that partly due to the attitudes and opposition of allies like those in the European Union?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, clearly the Bush administration is trying to not talk about the military option. While they say nothing's off the table, they don't even use the word that begins with an M. And to the extent that there's unity between Europe and the United States in some kind of sanctions, there's unity there. Whether that's a unity on behalf of an effective policy, I don't think so. I suspect that we're offering a carrot to the Iranians that is some civilian nuclear energy capacity, which is not what they want. They want nuclear weapons. And we're offering them a stick if they don't comply, which is something short of much punishment because we can't get real economic sanctions because of the Russians and the Chinese, at least, if not the Europeans as well. So therefore, we have a carrot that doesn't appeal and a stick that doesn't threaten. And I think most people are sort of fatalistic and expect that Iran will eventually go nuclear in X number of years. And so the whole policy will have failed, but it will have been a unified one.
Heinz Gardner, our professor at the Austrian Institute for International Affairs, what do you think about the Iranian issue? Is it fated to cause the United States and the European Union to fall apart again if, in fact, specific economic sanctions are brought up, not to mention the possibility of military action?
I don't think so far everything is fine because the United States decided to work within the framework of the international institutions, the International Atomic Energy Agency and the UN Security Council. So that's already different to the time before and during the Iraq war. At the beginning, the United States were very skeptical about this EU-3 initiative, but now the United States supported it. However, we don't have the crisis yet. If we do have a crisis, it might be possible that we have another transatlantic divide under one condition, if there is no clear authorization by the UN Security Council. The Europeans might support even military sanctions if there is an authorization by the UN Security Council. If there is a military intervention without an UN mandate, then there will be a transatlantic split within Europe again, and a divide which goes well into the individual countries. We have an old new Europe in a new way.
Assuming that Russia and China won't be happy about the idea of economic sanctions, Professor, do you think then it's more likely than not that there ultimately will, if there's a crisis, be another split between the United States and Europe?
I talked to Chinese and Russian officials, and they indicated If push comes to shove, they would support sanctions. But they both say we are not there yet, and we don't want to put pressure on Iran now. There's a long time to go. So if we are patient, we might get a UN Security Council resolution if Iran doesn't comply.
Tony Blankley, are you skeptical about Russia and Iran in this? Russia and China in this context. Do you think they will come around?
Well, I think American-Russian diplomacy has been one of the great disappointments of the last few years. I don't think Washington has managed that relationship at all well, and we badmouth them regarding their lapses in pure democracy. I was in Russia last year meeting with a lot of Russian academics and political figures late last year, and there's a lot of resentment. I don't think that's a context in which we're likely to get Russia to help us, when in fact they have huge economic gains to make out of doing business with Iran, and in the absence of any other motivation, why would they not continue on that path? So I blame the administration's Russia policy over the last couple of years. And to a certain extent, Putin has taken a lot of blame within his circles for not delivering enough from his earlier agreements with us regarding NATO expansion and the other issues. So it's not a healthy relationship. It's worse than it could have been, perhaps, and we're paying the price and not getting much Russian cooperation.
Frederica Leibel, let me go back to you. You're a European correspondent for the Austrian Daily De Presse. The president, as we understand it, has now arrived in Budapest in Hungary, a part of the old Soviet Empire, but now part of what Secretary Rumsfeld famously called the New Europe. Let's look forward a bit. What do you think are the prospects for the differences between New Europe and Old Europe to continue to be an important factor in international relations?
Well, there's one thing from the American side that divides Europe into Old Europe and Europe at the moment, that is the visa regime. The new member countries need, except for Slovenia, need visa to get into the United States. And this is a very pressing problem for Europe, and they have been urging the United States again and again to move on the visa requirements. But from what I hear in Vienna, there hasn't been any move from the American side.
Give us a little more background on that. Describe for our American audience what the visa issue is for the people in what's called New Europe.
Well, the so-called old EU member states like France and Germany or the UK don't need visas to travel to the United States. There's only one old country, which is Greece, that they need visa to travel to the United States. But all the new countries, except for Slovenia, Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, cannot travel to the United States without applying for a visa first. They feel very bitter about this, and the United States claims security reasons for that. They do not want to stop their visa requirements. And it is a diplomatic problem that is stressed behind the scenes again and again and again. But as long as there are security concerns from the American side, that doesn't seem to be any move.
Let me go back to T.R. Reid with the Washington Post. Interested in your take on this. You wrote about the United States of Europe at a time when the new Europe was really beginning to form up as an important element in all of these conversations. Do you think that the United States needs to reach out in context like this to those countries in order to keep them as close to the United States as they are now?
I don't think it's going to. I think divide and conquer is a policy towards Europe that's not going to work. I think old Europe, new Europe, is not going to work. In any case, in this visa issue, the whole of the original 15 countries, they're all on the side of the 10 new countries. They all think they should be able to enter the United States without a visa, just like they can. Rumsfeld, I think, the Bush administration has switched on this. Donald Rumsfeld was at a NATO meeting in Munich last year, and somebody said to him, "What's this business about old Europe and new Europe? What are you talking about?" And Rumsfeld said, "Let me just say, the defense secretary who made that comment was the old Rumsfeld, and we now see one Europe." And I think that is the Bush administration position in the second term, and it's much more popular with Europe than this attempt to divide in their first term.
Tony Blankley with the Washington Times. What about the visa regime then? Do you think that the United States is likely to drop its security concerns and allow people to come into the country more freely?
Probably not, although I don't have any recent information on that. But you know, it's not the Americans who talked about the Polish plumbers. There's plenty of division going on in the EU all by itself. When France voted 57% against the EU constitution, there was a lot of concern of a nationalist basis between the countries. And obviously, the EU as a unifying project is generally considered to be certainly at least stopped, if not in crisis. So the idea of a united Europe from west of Russia to the Atlantic, as wonderful a post-World War II project as it was, may not advance to its conclusion, and thus we may end up having what we've always had since Treaty of Westphalia, which is nations dealing with each other, divide et impera, and all the rest that have been the example of how nations do diplomacy with each other.
So, T.R. Reid, your book's called The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. Sounds like Tony Blankley is challenging your premise.
Yeah, I just don't see it Tony's way. He's brilliant. He may be right. But I think Europe is more unified today than any time since the Roman Empire. They've thrown away a lot of their currencies, adopted a common currency. They have a common market. Those 10 so-called new European countries are dying to join the euro. They're probably the most eager Europeanists on the continent. When Condi Rice spoke to the Polish parliament, she was introduced by the foreign minister there, who said, "I have told Dr. Rice that there is one Europe and Poland is in it." So the notion that somehow there's a division and we can use it to our benefit is a mistake. It didn't work, and it's a policy that the United States should drop.
Two views from the United States. Professor Gartner in Austria, do you think that Europe is as unified as it's been since the Roman Empire?
I don't think we shouldn't be too optimistic about that. European countries are highly integrated, but we are not moving towards a unified state or a single common foreign and security policy as many would have liked a couple of years ago. What we do have is variable geometry. We already have, if you take the example of Iran, we have a core Europe, the EU3. We have France, Great Britain, and Germany. And then we have a currency union which doesn't cover all the member states. And also the European security and defense policy is not supported by each of the countries. If it comes to the cooperation with the United States, some are more cooperating, others are less cooperating. And there was a good cooperation in the field of terrorism, but some countries took it too seriously, and they supported, with the knowledge of government or not, the rendition flights. To the embarrassment of the Commission and the European Parliament. So, and if it really comes to a crisis, I don't think so that Europe will be that united.
Okay.
I rather see an Iraq scenario again coming up then.
Well, thank you very much for that summary, and thank you all. We covered a lot of subjects today, and we appreciate it very much. Hans Gertner, Professor of Political Science, International Relations at the Austrian Institute for International Affairs. T.R. Reid with The Washington Post, author of The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. Tony Blankley, editorial page editor of The Washington Times. And Frederica Leibold, European correspondent for the Austrian Daily De Presse. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University have found a way to use stem cells to regrow the circuitry needed to move a muscle. The result has been that partially paralyzed rats are able to walk. In a moment more on what scientists call a breakthrough, how and when might it be applied to human beings? On To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at kcrw.com, keyword To the Point. You can also podcast the show at kcrw.com.
We're Manalny back with Popota's Notebook on To the Point. The stem cell breakthrough in paralyzed mice is being called a first step, a proof of principle. Application to human beings might be a long way off. Dr. James Batty leads the Stem Cell Task Force at the National Institutes of Health. Doctor, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
What has been done by these researchers at Johns Hopkins that had never been done before?
Well, the work done at Johns Hopkins by Douglas Kerr and his collaborators builds upon some outstanding research done previously demonstrating that embryonic stem cells can be coaxed into differentiating into motor neurons. These are the neurons that are the ones that send signals to our muscles, tells them to contract, that allow us to essentially move our muscles. What they did that has never been done before is to not only get the embryonic stem cells to differentiate into motor neurons, but to have them survive in the spinal cord and then successfully put out processes called axons, which are little cables that go out from the neuron carrying the signal to the muscle. And then at the muscle, they formed a specialized structure called a neuromuscular junction, which is necessary for the nerve to instruct the muscle to contract efficiently. And they, in fact, were able to demonstrate that the animal actually gained additional strength in the muscle in its limbs.
Now, were they able to do this by simply injecting the cells into the mice, or was there some process that had to take place as well?
The animal model was a rat animal model, and they were mouse embryonic stem cells that were used to generate the neurons in question. Now, the cells had to first be grown in a special way, be pretreated, then be put into the appropriate location in the spinal cord, and then additional growth factors and chemicals were added to coax the motor neurons to put out this axon and for the axon to grow in the right direction towards the muscle and form this specialized neuromuscular junction that's needed for proper function to take place.
So there's a lot to it then. It isn't simply a matter of sticking a needle in the animal and seeing these processes occur all by themselves.
That is correct. There were a number of steps that needed to be optimized for this study to work as well as it did in an adult animal.
Talking with Dr. James Batty, who heads the Stem Cell Task Force at the National Institutes of Health. You mentioned Dr. Douglas Kerr at Johns Hopkins, who led this work. He has also said that it may bring what he refers to as the appropriate tempering of expectations of stem cells. What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that he's provided a recipe, a potential route forward in a small animal model that might lead us at some point in the future to being able to use human embryonic stem cells under similar circumstances to treat patients with motor neuron disease in the spinal cord, diseases like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or spinal cord damage. But there are many steps that lie between his breakthrough and the initiation of a clinical trial to test a stem cell treatment for a spinal cord disorder. For example, in a human being, the distances over which these axons would have to grow is much, much longer than in the rat. So certainly an important next step would be to develop a larger animal model, for example, a pig animal model, and see if the same sorts of recipes and protocols work in that larger animal model. Secondly, it will be essential to demonstrate that the function that's been established is long-lasting in that animal model. A treatment will be of little benefit to a patient if it doesn't last for years and years after the stem cell treatment were to be performed. And then finally, one needs to be certain that the stem cells do only what we want them to do, which is to form motor neurons that put out axons to direct the muscles to contract and not do other things that would result in an unwelcome outcome that's difficult to predict. Without additional testing in a substantial number of animals, because some of these unwelcome outcomes might be rare, only 5 or 10% of the time. So you'd need to look at a number of animals before we could be confident that the treatment was safe.
So they're hard to predict, but is there some way you can indicate what sorts of unwanted models or outcomes, rather, might take place?
Well, one possibility, of course, when one is dealing with embryonic stem cells, which have an unlimited capacity to renew themselves, is that unlimited capacity to renew might not have been quenched completely by the pretreatment of the cells to get them to differentiate into motor neurons. And what I mean is let's say for the sake of argument that 5% of the cells remained undifferentiated embryonic stem cells, 95% of them were motor neurons. If these cells went on dividing and dividing and dividing and dividing like they were doing in culture before the treatment was initiated, this could result in a tumor.
Are there enough stem cells available to do the kind of research that you're saying is necessary?
Well, yes, that's one of the wonderful properties of embryonic stem cells that differentiate them from many other types of stem cells, and that's that as far as we know, they have an unlimited capacity to renew themselves in the laboratory, which means we have the capability to generate as many cells as might be needed for a given clinical application or scientific experiment.
And you can do that without destroying embryos, that being such an important issue for a lot of people?
Well, to create a human embryonic stem cell line, it's necessary to remove the inner cell mass from a five-day-old blastocyst. And if that's done in a human being, then you have destroyed a human embryo to create the cell line. Once the cell line is created, it can be propagated in the laboratory without any additional destruction of embryos.
All right. But the research we're talking about, I would assume, will lead to a demand for greater research, more research, and consequently more stem cells.
I think it gives us all hope that at some point in the future, cells derived from embryonic stem cells will be used to help patients.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. James Batty, once again, heads the Stem Cell Task Force at the National Institutes of Health. Today's program, produced by Andrea Brody, with Karen Radziner and Jonah King. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at kcrw.com, and the keyword is To the Point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.